Welcome to my Life and Times of Video Games interview side series on the people and processes behind games history. I'm Richard Moss. This time around, I speak to Kate Willett, who you may know for her videos and articles about games history, her infographics, or maybe just her excellent Twitter threads. Kate was actually one of the first people I invited for an interview in this series, back when I started planning it pre-pandemic. I've been intrigued by her research and her semi-random trivia drops for years, and so I was delighted when she emailed me earlier this year to say that she finally felt like we'd have enough to talk about. And, well, it turns out we had more than enough to talk about. In the interview you're about to hear, which was recorded on the 1st of May 2021, Kate and I talk at length about her games history research and current projects, as well as her efforts to turn this work into her job. We also voice our complaints about Google's Usenet archives, discuss the horrible world of YouTube publishing, the struggles of getting your work seen, read, heard as a content creator today, the value of a good hook for getting people interested in history, how to structure a historical narrative, our font choices for writing draft scripts, and much, much more. So here's our full discussion, trimmed down, edited, and just generally tidied up to make the conversation a little easier on the ears. Enjoy. So I guess to start, maybe we could go back to your longer running history thing, your Carmen Sandiego history work. How have you been going with that?
Oh, yeah, that one is a lengthy project. It originally started, I wanted to do just a short thing because, like, for years I'd done these infographics that were like the evolution of costumes of specific superhero characters, right? Where I would draw each costume and then write a little history about each one so you could see how it changed over time. And I wanted to do something like that for Carmen, but as a video, it was going to be about the different incarnations of Carmen, how her look and her personality changed. But the further that I dug into the history, I discovered that there was a lot of history of the making of the character that beyond the scope of what I wanted to do, that I felt like hadn't thoroughly been covered, you know, which seemed like a shame for such an iconic and recognizable character. Like, I feel like she's probably in the top 10 most recognizable video game characters of all time, even if people don't necessarily recognize her as a video game character. A lot of people think of her as more of a cartoon character or a game show character. Mm. So now it's this multi-part series that's focused more on how each of these chapters of her career kind of happened. And the first video I'm going to try to finish this summer is just going to be focused on the very first game, because it turns out the first game is so, the history is so complicated and convoluted that nobody has really gotten it quite right. And I'm going to try to do it right. I've talked to like at least a dozen people who were involved in that first game. It's like, and it takes talking to that many people to understand this game, because most games in the 80s were created by, well, most games were in the 80s were created by like one person, at most maybe three. So you can talk to like three people at most and get the full story. But this one, like, there were so many people who like had their little thing that they added to the character or to the game that nobody else was really paying attention to, kind of.
Yeah. I think it's quite often the best history projects start like this. It's just you're curious about something and you start digging and then you find out, oh, there's so much more here than anyone realized. And I need to tell it because no one else is doing it. Have you thought about making it a book, or are you really just set on articles and videos?
I think, well, there's multiple answers to that. Like with a topic as big as Carmen in particular, I think Carmen could become a book, and she's currently owned by a book company. So if the stars aligned, it would be kind of amazing to do an official Carmen biography. But for other topics, I'm not sure. I have ideas for graphic novels I'd like to do, kind of dramatized historical graphic novels, you know, like there are some people out there doing historical graphic novels. Like there's one on the history of Tetris that was really good, but it's good, but it's not like dramatized. It's very, it's super compressed, and I loved decompressed storytelling, you know? So I would want to do like kind of a, I'm trying to think of a good example of like a dramatized, you know, Netflix miniseries, you know, like something like that, but in graphic novel form, I guess, would be really fun to do someday.
It'd be cool to have that different style, and it would maybe be suitable for Carmen Sandiego with the way that it's been a transmedia series through its history.
Yeah. Well, the Carmen video, I was thinking more, I have ideas for graphic novels that are on other topics, like maybe like the beginning of video games, like how the first video games were made and some of the personality conflicts that exist in that. But with Carmen, the first video is actually going to be kind of transmedia because, like, I don't have enough images to fill all of the story beats that I'm trying to tell in the video. So I have to do illustrations. So, but I'm going to do the illustrations. Right now, the plan is to do the illustrations in the style of Apple II graphics. So it's going to be kind of this weird, like a comic book, but not panels, but also looking like a computer game. I don't know. It all looks really cool in my head. We'll see what happens.
Hopefully you can make it a realized vision. And I guess on a semi-related note, you've now also got this other really big, ambitious video project that you're working on, your 50-part series on playable female protagonists from games in the 1980s. Could you talk a bit about this project and how it got started?
Well, so This series originally started as, like, about 10 or 15 years ago, you'd see websites, like gaming websites, do like the top 10 women in gaming. And what they usually meant was the top 10 hottest characters. And sometimes they weren't even shy about it. They would just call it the top 10 hottest female characters. And I was like, I want to do my own list that is actually the top 10 best characters, not just like sexiest or whatever. And the problem is that I don't like to like half-ass anything. So I'm like, before I can, like, this list needs to be definitive. So first I need to compile a list of every single playable female character that's ever existed in the history of video games. And now, like 15 years later, I finished the 80s. So it just kind of turned to this thing where it's like, well, this isn't a top 10 list anymore. This is going to be the history. And then maybe I'll do a top 10 list. Yeah.
So 15 years it took you to pull it together. Was that, so did you have to go playing heaps and heaps of games to see if they had a female protagonist, or were you able to just pull that all together from slowly browsing through game listings and magazines and whatever?
Part of the reason it took so long was because I was learning how to research. Because when I started, I didn't really know what resources to use or where to go. I think I actually started by just asking on forums for like people to list as many games as they could think of that had playable female protagonists. But the real breakthrough was when I discovered that Moby Games has a tag for female protagonist, which really filled in a lot of the gaps, but not all of them, because they disclude certain things from their tag. Like, they only want games that force you to play as a female protagonist. So no games with a selection screen, no games where you can like choose from multiple characters. So that left a lot of gaps, but also their list wasn't complete either. So I had to find other ones elsewhere. You know, some of them came from those forum suggestions. Also, there's a website called Hardcore Gaming 101 that did a feature about playable female protagonists. And they had a bunch I didn't have, but I had a bunch they didn't have. So I sent them all of the ones I could think of. And I ended up getting a special thanks listing on that one. So that was kind of cool. But now I feel like I've looked at so many sources and talked to so many people. I feel pretty solid. Like, I've shown this spreadsheet to a bunch of people and they could not think of anything else to add. So
That's good. And I wouldn't be surprised if there are still some super obscure ones that you'd be missing, but I can't imagine it would be many, knowing how thorough you are these days.
Yeah, you never know. Probably like right after I finished the last one, but you know, like one will pop up. But I've kind of left some wiggle room in the way that I've set up the episodes, where I can always add one and move one somewhere else. Because after the initial 50, I'm also going to do some special episodes that are groups of characters that didn't fit my my very strict rules for how I'm narrowing this down.
And you have you've published those rules on your site, haven't you? Can you tell us about how you are shrinking that down and defining what a playable character is?
Yeah, so in my introductory video, I kind of lay out the rules. It's like an intro video to introduce you to the concept. And let's see, the first thing I wanted to do was focus just on games released in the US. And that's partly because the language barrier for games outside the US is so tough that if it wasn't, like, I want to talk about how the game fit into culture at large, but it's hard to talk about how it fit into the other cultures unless I get really lucky finding some resources, which in some cases I have. So I'll add that bit for some of these games that were released in America but were made in Japan or the UK. But I mean, with the UK, it's not so much a language barrier, but it feels like if I'm going to if I'm going to stay away from games that were only released in Japan, I should just do the same thing for the UK. But later I'll do special ones that are like, here's a group of UK only or Japanese only characters that I don't know a lot about, but you know, here's what I do know. And then the other restrictions are like, I want to focus on characters that are original to video games, so not movie characters or storybook characters, but I'll do special episodes for them too. And what was the third rule? I can't even remember all my own rules right now. Oh, the other rule was, well, the other rule is that they have to have a name. And part of that is because most of the protagonists that don't even have a name, there was so little thought put into who the character was, other than just, you know, like pixels on a screen, that there really isn't much to talk about, except for when there is. And then I'll do special episodes about them.
And how long do you think it's going to take you to get through these 50 plus videos?
I don't like to think about it.
I imagine it's going to be quite a while.
And however long it takes, you know, once I do the special episodes, the plan is to go into the 90s, you know. I want to get to the 90s eventually.
And then you, by the time you finish the 90s, you'll want to get into the 2000s, and you'll be a very old woman by the time you finish.
Will YouTube even be around still? I don't know.
Yeah. So you talked a bit just before about how when you started, you didn't know how to research. I thought that's a really interesting comment, because research, as you know, is quite difficult. And researching video game history is a bit particular. It's not exactly like researching history of most other things. So could you talk a bit about your research process nowadays and what you've had to learn along the way?
Well, so the first big breakthrough in my ability to research video games was when I discovered there were like entire runs of magazines that I could download to my hard drive and then do text searches for keyword terms. I think I happened on this originally because I'm very into like the etymology of terms, and I wanted to find the origins of certain video game terms. And it seemed like the only way to figure out some of that was to download like the earliest runs of certain magazines, like Electronic Games, not to be confused with Electronic Gaming Monthly, was pretty much the first gaming magazine in the US. And originally it started as a column in a magazine called Video Magazine. And thankfully, those all that video game content in those was scanned and put on Atari Compendium. The next big breakthrough was discovering the huge magazine archive on archive.org. I have a few things that I think maybe they don't have because it's been taken down, like by the copyright holders, but they also have a ton of stuff that I don't have that I didn't even bother downloading because it's so time consuming to download it all. So it's nice to just have it on there, and you can text search within those and narrow them by year and things like that. And then it becomes really easy to find information on certain specific topics you're looking for if you know how to search the right words.
And they're adding more stuff all the time as well, which is wonderful and also kind of frustrating sometimes.
Yeah. If you're doing a project that takes years to research, you want to check in occasionally and see if there's new sources that have been added. My frustration with Archive is currently is just that there are other communities that are not uploading magazines to the Archive that I wish would. Like, we're really good for video game stuff, but when it comes to comic book magazines, like news magazines from back in the day, I know that almost all of it has been scanned because there was a huge scanning movement like 10 or 15 years ago. But, you know, they didn't scan them as PDFs. They were into scanning them as CBRs, which was the comic format, and sharing them on like torrents and things like that. And I feel like none of them have thought to like just upload them to Archive. Like, it's right there. Just like Archive, if you upload comic runs, they'll probably get taken down. But the magazine runs, I think, are all good.
And so then you've also got other sources like Usenet, which has gotten way harder to search as Google have tried to bury that more and more.
There was an article like 10 years ago that somebody wrote after I complained on one of the Google help pages. I was like, you can't search these by date anymore. It's broken. Like, I use this for research and now like I can't. What's going on? And somebody actually wrote an article and actually mentioned me in it. And eventually they fixed it, but you have to know what to type.
Yeah.
They don't have a drop down. You have to be like, you know, from colon number number slash number number slash number number number.
Yeah. And it's also a little picky nowadays. I find that sometimes if you're trying to do a search range, you know, before this, after this, it's giving me results that are outside of that range as well.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, if you try to, either it won't let you search chronologically, or if you do try to sort it chronologically, it'll just break. I don't know. It's been a while.
Yeah, it breaks. Some of the results you can't look at anymore. And you can also only sort from newest to oldest. So if you're wanting to go in the opposite direction, it's really annoying. You've got to keep clicking until you get to the end, if you get to the end.
Right. And when you go to groups.google now, they default you to like searching in my groups, which I have none. So, but it's still, you have to hit the drop down to search all groups. And there's also certain groups that for some reason have been blocked forever because supposedly they were getting a lot of spam, and so instead of dealing with it, they just locked it. So like if you're the type of nerd who's trying to search about the Pink Floyd Publis Enigma, you can't, because the whole Pink Floyd group is like locked. You can't search anything from it.
And it's great that there are people now who are getting new Usenet searching repositories up, but none of them are as complete, anywhere near as complete as Google's so far. So
yeah,
it's just a necessary evil still, and we pray that they don't kill the product completely. Now, are there other go-to history resources that you like to look at when you're doing your research?
I'm trying to think of them all now. Archive is the big one. Books.google.com is really good too for finding certain sources, because like InfoWorld magazine, for example, has been removed from Archive. So, but you can view full pages of it on books.google.com. Mm. There's also some other magazines not on Archive that are on a site called American Radio History, which they were like one of the first to have a huge run of Billboard magazine online and all sorts of other music and television. You know, it's American radio history, but they include a bunch of television stuff on there for reasons.
And do you do newspaper searches as well?
Oh, yeah. There's newspapers.com, and then there's newspaperarchive.com. I don't personally have accounts to them, though. So when I search those, it's usually through Google. And then I'll add a site colon and the site name to search for keywords available from those sites.
Interesting. I got an account on newspapers.com towards the end of last year because I really needed it for one of my book projects.
Yeah, it's super useful when you have an account. What I do is when I find something useful via my Google search, which the Google search isn't as good as searching in the site when you have an account. But if I find some good stuff with the Google search, I'll ask around to who currently has an active account and be like, hey, can you grab a page for me?
Mm-hmm. So back on the videos, you've published a bunch of videos so far this year, and you're obviously pretty focused on doing more YouTube going forward. How are you finding this sort of horrible world of YouTube publishing?
Oh, it's horrible. Getting started is the hardest part because they don't recommend you on the algorithm until you're already huge. So most of it is trying to find ways to self-promote. And self-promoting was way easier like 10 years ago. Like when I started doing those superhero infographics, it was pretty easy. I have a friend who is a regular on Reddit. And so he'd like occasionally just post my stuff when I had a new thing. Because he posts all sorts of stuff, and they have rules. They have rules against self-promotion, and also rules against like constantly just promoting the same one site, you know? So this friend is always linking to all sorts of stuff, and we'll throw my things in there occasionally. And 10 years ago, it was pretty easy to just have it go up and people would see it and they'd love it and they'd upvote it and it would blow up and then it would spread all over the internet. But then either the moderators or the algorithm or whatever would just like people stopped liking infographics. And so they'd start like downvoting them just for being an infographic, or maybe the moderators would lock them, or maybe it would get hidden as spam, or, you know, it just, it's the same kind of thing with all content, it feels like, is they're very selective about, I don't know, there's so much luck involved, like, you have to post it at the right time, that the right people are going to see it and upvote it to counter all the downvotes.
And you can't necessarily predict when the right time is either. It can change.
Yeah, there is no specific right time. It's all luck. But the thing about YouTube is that the people who do are very successful YouTubers. They usually all have a very similar story where they had a slow, gradual, solid growth. And then eventually they had that one big hit on Reddit. And that one big hit is what gave them a huge audience suddenly, you know? So it's like, it's just waiting for the stars to align and getting that big hit.
When I started this audio thing, I had thought Reddit can help me get a strong audience. And Once I'd made an episode that I thought was really strong, I went to Reddit to publish it, to share it there on the r/games. And pretty much immediately it gets removed because no podcasts are allowed whatsoever. Blanket rule. I asked the mods, told them, you know, I make this documentary thing. It's not like people were just having a chat on a like a round table chat. I do these serious, proper documentaries. They're just in audio form. And they go, no, sorry. Only way we'll allow you to post is if you do a self-post. And to do a self-post, you have to make sure that you're contributing a whole lot of stuff to the discussion. And you just happen to have a link there.
Yeah, it's so tough. And part of it is because, you know, there are so many people producing bad content that are trying to self-promote, and it just like floods. If you allow it all in, it does just flood Reddit with bad content, but it makes it so hard for the people who are doing quality, thoughtful stuff, you know?
And so I've been kind of amused to find that my biggest growth vector has been Hacker News. When people randomly post my episodes to Hacker News, I occasionally will hit the front page.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. I think I had that happen once on Hacker News, but I can't remember what it was. But I definitely remember something like that. But I've never posted there myself, so I don't even know if that's a place where people self-promote, or do you just have to wait for one of the influential people on there to see your thing and be like, hey.
I've fiddled with it a little bit, and they seem to be really open to just anyone starting an account and posting whatever. There's no rules that I've seen against self-promotion, and I have, half a dozen times posted my own stuff, and I think one of those times it was successful.
It wasn't Hacker News. It was, there's a similar related one, I can't remember, but somebody shared a bunch of my Moonlander Easter egg stuff and was really thorough, linking to like everything I've done on it.
So continuing on the video front, but let's come back to that Moonlander thing in a moment. So you've broken a lot of new ground this year, a whole bunch of that ground in writing about that one game. You've got, you know, first playable female sprite, first cutscene, first Easter egg, first walking animation, and some other stuff that you've all been digging up and marking earlier date.
Yeah, like over the last 15 years, I've been compiling all these research projects and doing research on them, and then just getting distracted and moving on to the next one instead of, you know, like finishing it. And so I have like 50 topics probably that I just need to finish. And for launching this channel, I was like, well, since I have all these topics to choose from, I'm going to front load this with the bits of forgotten history that I think are most compelling and most likely to just like blow people's minds, you know, in hopes of getting, you know, that big hit. And so far it hasn't happened, you know. I tried, but it's that luck factor, you know. But I have a few more big hits coming up. Like, everyone loves Metroid. I love Metroid. Metroid is like my, Samus Aran is my like favorite video game character of all time. So I'm doing this special that is outside of the realm of my video game series that I think has some special reveals in there that hopefully will blow up the internet. But, you know, it's luck. Who knows?
Yeah. As we're getting that there, and you've complained about this before, you never know which thing is going to be the one that blows up, and it's often not what you think it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. I know, which is why it's probably going to be my next video, which is Video Dames Number Zero, which is a special about a bunch of nameless characters who are naked. And it's basically the anti-algorithm video. Everything about this video is not the video you want to make to try to get an audience, because I have to set it as, you know, for adults, which is different than setting it as not for kids, okay? Because for adults is content that is a little more adult, but not so adult that they're going to ban it from YouTube. But like setting it to for adults, they're not going to recommend that video at all. You know, and it's going to require people to sign in order to watch it. And it's like, you know, it's a really compelling topic, though. It's a story I think needs to be told. But at the same time, it's like, this is not the hit, unless it is, because it's the one I least expect.
Yep. Yeah, it could be. It could just somehow happen, and they're always changing the algorithm too. So you never know if they might suddenly allow one through.
It could turn out that Reddit just really loves videos about naked people, and it becomes a huge hit. I don't know.
It's Reddit. I wouldn't be surprised.
I mean, it's naked women. I'm kind of being critical, but maybe it'll still be an entertaining video for people who just want to see pixelized representations of, like, are they even really naked when most characters were one color anyways?
Mm. Are they naked if you can't see the bits properly?
Right.
So on the subject of these historical firsts and early precedents for things, what do you think it is that about them that makes them matter? What do we gain in the big picture by identifying these, or trying to identify them correctly?
Oh, yeah. There's a danger of being too obsessed with firsts and just, like there are people who are critical of being obsessed with firsts when you get to the really like specific ones, like that are like the first that in a that was that, you know, like, does this even matter? Why are there so many asterisks, you know, here? But I think the importance of firsts is that it's so hard to get the average person interested in history that you can use a first to bridge the gap from something today that they can relate to that's now to look at something in the past that otherwise they would have no interest in knowing about, you know? So it's just like, it's just a tool. It's a tool in the toolbox to, you know, get people more interested in history, which is important just because, you know, like understanding where we came from is important to understanding where we can go in the future.
Mm. Yeah, which is a good general thing for why the history matters. And I like that idea of thinking about the firsts as a hook rather than the goal in itself. It's the hook for getting people intrigued.
Yeah, hook is one of my favorite words. I am all about hooks in movies, hooks in music, you know, the hooks brings you back. That's exactly what it is. I just love hooks, and it's a really solid, useful one.
And that's maybe the perfect entry point for talking about this recent thing on Moonlander and just the Lunar Lander type games and the work you've done digging into the origins of each of these. And could you talk a bit about these for us?
Yeah, well, since we were talking about hooks and firsts, like Moonlander is so many firsts at the same time. More firsts than I ever imagined when I was first made aware of it. And I can't even remember how I was first made aware of it. But like I'd heard that it potentially had a first Easter egg, like an Easter egg that predates all the known Easter eggs. And I was doing a project on the first Easter egg because I wanted, I was going to do this hook that was like, you know, Ready Player One was wrong. There's all these Easter eggs that were before it. And then I discovered Moonlander and had to revise my idea slightly. But I mean, I still used Ready Player One as a hook, for better or worse. I think it's pretty funny, but a lot of people just got hung up on Ready Player One and wanted to complain about the movie instead of talking about Moonlander. But so Moonlander also ended up, once I, it's a long story, but once I was able, I and a friend of mine were able to finally play it, we discovered that it had like the first on-screen representation of a human, and the first overworld map, and the first gameplay to take place across multiple screens, and the first cutscene. Like, that one blew me away. I was like, I thought I knew what the first cutscenes were, and it was, here's this way older one, you know, like right in here. And it's connected to the first Easter egg, and it was just like, wow, this video is going to blow up the internet. And then it didn't, but what can you do?
Yeah, I thought it was so cool to find out that it was a McDonald's. Like, whoa.
Yeah. A McDonald's.
Of all the things that it would be, you know, not some little hidden name as the myths go for the first Easter egg, not some little really personal reference, just this big corporate overlord just before it became a big corporate overlord.
Right. Like, it, yeah, it's a joke. It, there's a lot of humor in the game, very subtle humor. And instead of being like an important creator moment, it was a gag.
It's interesting to me how 1973 seems to be a really critical year in the history of games. You've got this thing, Moonlander, then there's also a number of important early Plato games and some other stuff happening on mainframes. I wonder what it is about 1973 that made it a major year for cool ideas.
It's a good question. And if I thought about it long enough, if I sat here long enough, I could probably speculate. My first instinct to say is that it's just about the stage computer technology was in at that point, that it allowed for things that maybe weren't possible just a few years earlier. Because Moonlander was made possible because of the screen, basically. You know, the Plato games, they weren't using teletypes either, you know. They had monitors too in 73, right? Or were they on?
Yeah, they were using plasma screens in 73.
Okay. I couldn't remember the details. I wasn't sure they had the orange glow already, but you know, like, screens open up all sorts of possibilities. So, you know, you have Odyssey being released in 72 and Pong being released in 72. And I, like there was computer space and space war before those, but Pong, you know, was the first big hit video game. And, you know, part of that was just, I think, the availability of those screens at that point.
Mm. And I forget who it was that said it to me, but I think it was one of the guys who worked on Maze, whether it was Dave Lebling or one of the original creators of the high school version. They were saying that they don't really consider themselves to be this great innovator or inventor or something, because things just, they get created when the technology in the world is ready for them. And if it hadn't been them, someone else would have come up with the same idea probably very soon after. They're just right place, right time.
Yeah, that's fair. Like, you know, even Odyssey wasn't the first tennis game played on a screen. Oh, should I elaborate?
Sure, let's elaborate. Let's not assume that people know anything about it.
Yeah, that's true. We should explain. Because before Odyssey's, like Pong ripped off Odyssey's tennis game, but also improved on it. But before Odyssey, there was a demonstration called, well, actually, it wasn't called Tennis for Two, I learned recently. Tennis for Two is like some sort of name that was given to it out of one of the court hearings, one of the big lawsuit things around Magnavox. But it was just like computer tennis, and it used I can't remember what the type of screen is called, but it's not intended for playing games. It's intended for, you know, scientific uses.
It was like an oscilloscope, wasn't it?
Yeah, an oscilloscope. That's what I'm pretty sure it was. And it was tennis from side view instead of overhead view. And, you know, it was seen by very few people, because it was only demonstrated at like an event 2 years in a row, and then was put away and never really talked about again until some lawyers managed to dig it up or whatever. But the founder of Creative Computer Magazine, David All, actually was at one of those demonstrations and saw it, apparently. Like, it didn't lead him to make tennis games, but I mean, it's just fascinating that somebody that's kind of important to the history of documenting video games of the time was there to see it.
Yeah, it's, and David Al is a massively important figure in figuring out how we would talk about games, I think, as well.
Yeah, he's definitely one of several. I think the people who started Electronic Games Magazine probably did a lot more in terms of coining terms, and establishing a way to talk about games in a journalistic sense, but. Yeah, I don't know. Incomplete thought. I haven't really. I keep meaning to read through more of Creative Computing, because I've only really browsed it for particular bits of history that are useful to me. So, you know, it might be that he did coin a bunch of terms that I just have not discovered yet. You know, because, you know, he wouldn't be the one coining arcade game terms, you know. Maybe there's some computer-specific terms that one day I'll come across and be like, oh, hey.
I guess when it comes to etymology, you never know whether something has been used by just ordinary people playing the games for like a year, 2 years before it winds up getting used in a magazine or a book.
Yeah, that's true too. You know, you're limited with the first time it appeared in print, not the first time it was ever said. Like, I was looking into the origin of the term dungeon master at one point, and the first place it was used in print was in an early Dungeons and Dragons clone. You know, one of the early clone companies used the term in their book, and but apparently, as far as the author of that book knows, it was something he picked up from conventions or whatever you called them at the time. You know, just gatherings of people playing the games.
And you actually have an etymology question in that Moonlander research you did with trying to figure out the origins of that name, Lunarlander. Can you talk us through that a little bit?
Well, so this is a good chance to mention one of my other big research resources, which is Gaming Alexandria. It's a website, but on the website they have a link to their Discord. And their Discord server has all sorts of gaming history people hanging out and discussing things and helping each other out, you know? Like, I'll go on there and think out loud about things I'm researching, and people will give alternate theories, or maybe they researched a thing and they know the answer that I was looking for, you know, or maybe I know the answer they were looking for. So it's a great place to trade and, you know, a good place to exchange knowledge. And so I was actually on there thinking out loud about Lunarlander. Like, why is everyone defaulting to Lunarlander? Why does this happen? And I can't remember what some of the suggestions were, but then I was digging around and I was like, wait, there was this electromechanical lunar lander. And it's, you know, the room was like, oh, right, that one. We forgot about that because, you know, we like to talk about electromechanical games on there occasionally too. You know, it's an aspect of arcade game history that too many people forget even exists, that there were arcade games before there were video games, you know? It's kind of wild. But yeah, so there was this non-video lunar landing game where you land a toy on a toy lunar lander on a sculpted moon, because that's what they did before video games. It's just it's just bizarre.
You did your digging and you found that there were quite a lot of potential origin points before you got to that. Or did you get to that first and then you went looking of what other early examples are there that might have explained how it became the phrase that people use?
Oh, well, that was the last one I found and the one that made me go, I think this is it. But I included other examples like the teletype one. I mentioned the teletype one there as part of the narrative just because I wanted to find I wanted to mention it in relation to this because a lot of people who played Moonlander back in the 70s also played this teletype version, and the two were connected in their heads. So I'm like, I have to mention this somehow. And that just seemed like the easiest way to fit it in was as part of this narrative and kind of structured to hopefully make it kind of dramatic, you know, like, well, here's a possibility, but oh, look at this, you know. I try to do a lot of, like the South Park writers, they called it but and therefore, I think, where to move a story along, you want to be like, this happened, but then this happened, therefore this happened, but this happened, because there's that, that creates a sense of drama that drives the story forward. Instead of just listing things like, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And I've done articles that are just like listing events. And then I'll read them later and I'll be like, wow, this was really boring.
I was just thinking that. Yep, boring.
My very first video I did, which was like a year or two ago, I did an etymology video that I'm constantly tempted to maybe just remove because it's not at the same quality as my current videos. It was at a time when I was afraid of using music beds because I thought they were too easy. And the structure of that video is way too much. And then it was just, it has a great twist in there, but people were tuning out before they got to the twist because it was just like, well, you already told me where it started. So why am I watching this?
And sometimes I find the most enjoyable way to structure things when you want to keep that sense of mystery is to do it non-linearly and jump around according to what's going to fit the neatest together in the way you tell your story.
Oh yeah, that works too. You know, that's a great tool to use when the chronological history doesn't have much drama. But I like to use chronological whenever possible just because it does a better job of contextualizing the events, you know, so that people don't get confused about the order that the history happened in.
Mm.
But sometimes it's just necessary. Like the current video I'm working on, you know, you have a bunch of overlapping events happening, and it's confusing to go back and forth between all these different people. So you gotta like tell one story and then back up a bit and tell the next one.
Yeah, that's probably the storytelling style I do the most often, because overlapping events, they very often have only a tenuous connection to each other. And often that connection is something that we only find when we're looking at it from now, and they weren't aware of each other at the time, even though they were doing very similar things in parallel.
Yeah, exactly.
So on a related note, in your research, I feel like you tend to go way down into the weeds on things.
Like I do.
even beyond, like, down to the little insects and worms that are living among the weeds, you go right down as far as you can go, finding all those little connections and technical details. And I'm curious, what is driving you to do this? What's interesting to you about the finer details of history?
Yeah, I one of my recent articles I described to somebody as a dive so deep that it touches the bottom and surfaces in a completely different pool. But what drives me is just like a constant curiosity, you know? Kids, when they reach a certain age, they start asking why about everything.
Hmm.
And eventually the adult runs out of answers and usually gets annoyed and tells them to stop. But like, I kind of never grew out of it. Like, obviously I learned to not annoy adults, but I'm always asking why about everything. you know, when it comes to, you know, different careers I've had, I'm always asking why when it comes to processes. But in terms of history, I'm always asking why, you know, like I'm not satisfied with just this happened. I'm like, well, why did this happen? You know, why this and that? And so I have all these questions and I keep digging, trying to answer them. And some of them never have answers. Some of them are unanswerable, but I dig as far as I can to try to answer, you know, as much as possible.
And I like that because so much of the history of video games traditionally is like laser focused. I mean, people get so preoccupied with the questions of what and when, and occasionally who, and they very rarely get into why and how. And I feel like it's the why and the how that are the really interesting parts.
I don't disagree.
So a huge amount of this asking why all the way down that you do doesn't make it into your articles for, I think, obvious reasons. You don't want to overwhelm people. But then you do this interesting thing where you then go on Twitter and you post these threads. Like recently you're talking about how an Apple II Muppets game connects to Carmen Sandiego. And I know you got a lot of attention, surprisingly, about the all your bass music video thread. And there was the Bantran search. You're trying to find the Wabbit developer. So I guess I've got a couple of questions here. First, what's driving you to post these things? Is it just you don't know where to put these things you find interesting, but you can't put somewhere else? Or is there something else going on there?
Well, there's two kinds of threads that I'm doing now. One I've been calling tangents, which are leftover bits of information that didn't make it into a video, because, you know, I try to make the narrative of the video as tight as possible, and tangents just kind of can throw things off if you're weaving all over the place. So I'll post these interesting tangents that didn't quite fit as threads, but then the other threads are usually me in the process of researching a thing, and I'm not sure if this bit of information is actually going to make it into the final product or not, but I find it so fascinating in that moment that I want to tell people about it. And I want to see their reaction and see if they're as excited about this this little revelation as I am. And then I have all the other, you know, like I would be so tempted to tweet out every revelation I come across, but sometimes I actually have self-control and I'm like, no, this is going to be best. The reveal happens in the video, you know? And so with like this Metroid video I'm working on, recently I did a thread about Metroid, updating a previous thread about Metroid, that the things I'm tweeting are going to be in this upcoming video, but there are still additional revelations that I have been so tempted to tweet about that have been so hard to stop myself that I'm like waiting for the video, you know, because some of this, I need people to be surprised by the video and hopefully share, you know, like, oh my gosh, I didn't know this, you know? But yeah, basically the short answer is I tweet out all this history out of a lack of self-control.
Yep.
Otherwise, I would probably be holding off on the reveals and organizing the threads into proper articles.
And I sort of have the opposite issue. but I don't share enough of my discoveries.
Yeah. There was a long time where I didn't share anything. I held off on sharing anything that might be a great surprise for reveal. And I only had like 200 followers. And eventually so what happened was there was a certain point where I was feeling kind of down about my career and how few followers I had. And I was thinking about just giving up on the whole history thing and on various things. And I thought, well, I should at least share this information rather than just holding on to it and never doing anything with it. So I started just tweeting out things that I was like, I'll probably never finish this research project. And they started getting shared a lot. And once they started getting shared by really big accounts, I started gaining a lot of followers. And so now I'm up to 2,000, and most of that is probably just from people seeing threads and following me, you know?
Mm. Yeah, and then if you're trying to play the game of getting more views on YouTube, the more followers you have on Twitter, the greater the likelihood that somebody, the right person, is going to retweet you, and then you'll get the sudden influx of new views.
Yeah, most of my YouTube followers right now are pretty much from Twitter because YouTube isn't recommending anything. So I'm too small for that. So I reached my first 1,000 just last month. And yeah, it was pretty much all from Twitter and maybe some external sites also.
Do you find it, demoralizing how slow it can be to get attention when you do really good stuff?
Yeah, like you really want quality stuff to rise to the top, and you think, I don't know, I think it's harder for me because I experienced around 2013 when it was easier for good stuff to surface on Reddit, you know, and I could see my work immediately just blow up and hit the front page. And now it's so hard, and that part is, you know, demoralizing.
Mm.
I think, it's also hard because, you know, if I hadn't experienced that, I probably would have just gone, well, this is impossible, and I'm going to just give up. And then life would be easier because I'd given up. But instead, I feel like there's a chance. So I keep obsessively trying to make it happen.
Yeah, and it's become very real for you now, hasn't it? Because you're still currently unemployed.
That is true. I am still currently unemployed and trying. So, like, I have savings that I'm burning through, kind of on a wager that maybe I can make this happen. Maybe I can pay my rent with YouTube so that I can focus on just doing research and presenting that research to people full time without any other distractions, you know? And like, YouTube is the focus just because it seems like that's the place where that is probably going to be most possible, because doing that with a blog doesn't seem like something you can really do anymore.
Yep.
But then, is YouTube something you can really do it with anymore? That's the big question, you know? Like, is it still possible to become big on YouTube, or is there just too much competition now? you know, too many people doing video essays that it's hard to be seen the way that 15 years ago you could build a following by blogging, but now that's impossible.
Yeah. And you know, you'd really like to think that it's as simple as you create something amazing and people will find it, but it's not true anymore. You can create something amazing, and even if you then try and market it, you may just be yelling into the void.
Yeah, there's just so much to consume on the internet, so much constantly being made. It's impossible there's so much quality stuff being made everywhere in all realms that it's like impossible to keep up practically. Like, I know there's all sorts of shows that are Amazon Prime exclusives that I think were great that people slept on because there's too much to keep up with. You should have watched The Tick, all of you people who didn't watch The Tick.
So back to the Twitter thing, the other question I was going to ask was, do you have favorites among the many threads that you've done?
Oh, geez. I don't know if I can say I have personal favorites because I don't experience the twists the way that, you know, the readers do, but I can tell when a twist is really successful, and that's extremely satisfying. Like my most, you know, the twists are hard because sometimes you're like, this should probably be the hook, because if I don't put this up front, they're not going to read the rest. But then you're like, if I put this at the end, it'll have the most impact because it, like, people aren't expecting it. They don't see it coming, you know? And one of those threads would be a thread I call City Boy Mario, which I don't know if I should spoil it on here because it was a great twist. It was a twist that worked out so well that people were retweeting it saying, this does not end how you expect. It's just like, oh, that's like the best compliment. And they're not even giving me a compliment. They're just stating what they perceive as a fact. But that it worked that well is just like the greatest compliment.
I think the only thing that's a real shame about doing these threads in the way you do is that Twitter is so ephemeral. Now, I know that you link to them on your newsletter after the fact, but the people aren't likely to just stumble across them, which is a shame.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's weird. People will revive them sometimes, and I'm not sure why. Like, they might be using the search. They might be searching for terms and come across it. I have a few that get revived occasionally, like a thread about why it's okay to not defend Comic Sans. that I tied into NaNRIMO, or however you pronounce it, you know, the yearly writing exercise, that I think people search that term and or search Comic Sans and probably come across it and retweet it again. But, it starts out as why it's okay to, you know, why Comic Sans isn't special at all. Because people often say it's the best font for dyslexia, and yet there are dyslexic people out there who, some of them say it worked for me, and others say, no, this is, I hate this font too. And my thread was actually giving a really great writing tip about how to get the good effect people are experiencing from Comic Sans without using Comic Sans, which is that because Comic Sans uses larger letters, it takes up fewer characters per line in your document. And studies have shown that fewer characters, that there's this sweet spot of characters per line that's between like 40 and 75.
Mm.
That is the easiest to read. If the line has too many words on it, you start to get lost on that, and the words around it, like the lines above and below it, you're like, you start to get lost on where to start. And but if there's too few words on the line, then you start feeling like you're reading down instead of reading across. So you hit this sweet spot, and what happens is when people start a document and they have like a 10-point or 12-point, you know, like default font, you switch to Comic Sans. There's fewer lines on the page, or fewer words per line, I mean, sorry.
Hmm.
And you're like, wow, this is somehow easier to read, and I don't know why. But if you just change it to like Helvetica and then size it up to 13 or 14, you get the same effect, you know? And so when I write all my YouTube scripts, I am writing in Arial or Helvetica in lucky number 13 point.
Hmm. That's cool. Yeah, I've done some study on that stuff too. Back at university doing my journalism master's, I took some publishing electives and got to learn about those those same things in mainly in the context of like doing book typography, but it's the same essential idea. When I do my writing, if you're curious, I use either Cochin or Avenir Next. Those are my two go-to typefaces.
Yeah, those are fun.
And of course, I will change the size to be comfortable to read, because I'm writing big, long documents. I don't want to get lost in my own writing.
Right.
And on Comic Sans, I remember I was at a session at GCAP, which is like the Australian GDC, and there was a typeface designer talking about designing typography for video games. And he, of course, talked about Comic Sans. And I think he was arguing that every typeface in the world is perfect for at least one use case. And I think with Comic Sans, he joked that it was only right for that one use in the original Microsoft program that it was designed for.
I agree, because it was designed for the text of like a dopey dog character. And, you know, if you're going to have a dopey dog or a dopey character in general, you know, Comic Sans is kind of perfect for that.
Now, are there any other history projects that you wanted to talk about?
That's a good question. Not really that I can think of. I think I've already mentioned the three that I am most preoccupied with right now, which is the next video games with the naked characters, my Metroid thing, and then after that is going to be the first part of Carmen Sandiego, and I am... I'm hoping to make a trip to the Strong Museum at some point this summer to visit the Broderbund collection, the Broderbund papers that Doug Carlston donated to there, so that I can. It's basically the last piece I need to start wrapping up the first part of this big epic.
Since we did this interview, Kate completed a week-long research fellowship at the Strong Museum of Play, so look out for the fruits of that labor in the coming months.
Yeah, but I've been looking forward to the Carmen Sandiego thing for, I don't know, like 3 years or something. And you've been talking about it on and off for a long time.
I know, it's been quite a project, and you know, like, part of what's made it tough is that, like I mentioned before, that the scope changed dramatically since I started working on it. I only recently realized that, like, at a certain point, I was still going to do my original concept and then do a separate video about the making of the first game. You know, it was only recently that I realized it should be about the full history, but instead of just focusing on the first game, I'm so paranoid of some of these people dying on me that I keep interviewing people that are way ahead in like part three, you know, of the series, just because I'm like, I'm so gonna regret it if I just focus on part one and then I lose a chance to talk to these people. Cause I, you know, a bunch of us in Gaming Alexandria have missed out on talking to certain people cause we were waiting. And now it's just like, oh my gosh, every time I realize that I want to talk to somebody for anything video game related and they're above a certain age, it's like, oh, I need to talk to them now as soon as possible. But it gets really distracting from actually finishing things, you know. But like, that's, I pushed really hard to track down the producers of the Carmen Sandiego game show at PBS because, you know, they're some of the oldest of all the people that I would be interviewing. So, you know, and they were tough to track down because they're retired producers in like Los Angeles or whatever. Mm-hmm. But eventually I got to them, so.
That's good. I can't think off the top of my head of whether there's any that I've missed completely that I had like started to think about before they died and then they died. I know there's plenty that I want to talk to them and I've tried to look them up and found out, oh, damn, they died 5 years ago or something like that. But it's usually just they die before they get on my radar as an interview subject.
When I was researching Electronic Games Magazine for my first video, one of the first people I ever reached out to talk to was Arnie Katz. And he's married to Joyce Worley. And she would have been a great interview. I was like, I'm going to interview her one day. But then she like died a year later. I didn't realize that she'd been in poor health for many years at that point.
Mm. I remember Benj Edwards was talking about this not that long ago, how he had looked back at his list of people that he was going to interview and realized that a whole bunch of them had died and he'd missed his chance to save that history because he had put it off. He'd gone, well, I'm really busy right now. And he's realized now, oh, I should have just done it. I should have found the time.
Yeah, it's tough because there's so many people to talk to and so little time. It might not necessarily be possible to talk to everyone.
And it doesn't help either. I think that sometimes these older people are really hard to find now because they've retired and they didn't. You know, it's not always. They might not have a LinkedIn account. They might not have other social accounts, and so you've got to really rely on someone knowing how you can reach them. I always avoid the cold calling, though. If I find a phone number, that creeps me out, the idea of randomly calling them because I found their number.
Yeah, like 20 years ago, cold calling was a common part of being a journalist, I'm told, from journalists who were journalists 20 years ago, but Now it in today's weird privacy, it feels weird to just randomly call people in a way that doesn't feel weird to just randomly email them, or even, you know, one of my friends will occasionally write thoughtful letters to them in the mail, and then attach like an email address or phone number. And that actually works with that older generation sometimes.
Because they would remember the practice of letter writing, which has died out in our generation.
Whereas with a younger person, it might be creepy that somebody got your address, but...
Yes, very much. I had just a little funny story. I had someone who I found through some email finding thing, got in touch with him. He agreed to an interview, wanted it to be over the phone. And so then I called him at the time we were going to talk. His wife answered. I started introducing myself. She hung up on me. She thought I was a spam call.
Right. Like that, like older people in particular have to be careful about scams and things like that. People trying to identity theft them or whatnot.
So I had to, I was like freaked out. Well, shit, what do I do now? And decided, well, I'll call back in 5 minutes and hopefully he'll answer. And instead what happened was she answered again, but I had revised my introduction to really get to the point as quickly as possible. And then when I started talking to him, she was in the background apologizing profusely for hanging up on me.
Oh, well. I had one former developer who mentioned to me that when I emailed them, that they looked around on the internet to see if I was for real or just a scammer. Like, you know, some person saying, oh, I'm a historian and I want to know, you know, more about you. I guess, you know, if you don't, depending on what you do or don't know about scammers, that could seem like an in for somebody looking for your personal details or whatever.
Be a lot of work, though, if you were a scammer to dig up specific info about someone's games that they worked on and try and use that as your in. You'd really have to think, this is a good target. This person's got some real serious money that I can get.
Yeah, I don't see a way that you could use historian as a way to get their like social security number or anything, but you know, maybe not. Yeah, you could only get like work details, and then what do you do with that? I don't know.
Okay, so is there anything else that you can think of that you'd like to talk about, or you know, anything you wanted to ask me?
Oh, I did not have any questions prepared.
I'm not expecting anything. It's just something I like to ask just in case.
All right. Well, I just remembered an additional point about resources for research in game history, which is that I should definitely mention the book They Create Worlds, which is like the new textbook for games history. You know, like a lot of people got into games history from reading Stephen Kent's Ultimate Guide to, what is it called? Ultimate Guide to Video.
Yeah.
No, it's Ultimate History like Video. You know, when it came out, it was one of the few that existed. So it was like, if you wanted to read a history book on video games, that was it. And a lot of new information has come to light since then that has kind of made a lot of facts in there incorrect. You know, like they're no longer up to date. But They Create Worlds is like the new most correct history you can read. Unfortunately, it's also the publisher priced it like a textbook, so it's kind of pricey, but if you're into researching it, and right now it's only volume one, which mostly covers the 70s and like the very beginning of the 80s, you know, like volume two will be more of the 80s. But if somebody's serious about researching, like that has to be in your book collection, like whether physical or digital. I have it digital because I like to keyword search all of my stuff. I've stopped filling my bookshelves. I have a few very large history books on other topics that I'm like, oh, I should have bought this digital because now I would have to buy it again in order to keyword search.
My thanks again to Kate for taking the time to talk to me. You can find her work at acriticalhit.com and on the A Critical Hit YouTube channel. And here's how you can support her.
So I have a Patreon, which is at patreon.com/... just a second. I want to double check this to make sure I'm saying it right. So I have a Patreon that's at patreon.com/acriticalhit. That's for if people want to support my work financially. If people can't support it financially because we're in tough times and a lot of people are unemployed, you know, signal boosting helps. You know, you can signal boost my YouTube videos, which are at youtube.com/acriticalhit. I also have a website, acriticalhit.com, which links to all the videos and the articles that I do. And I have the Twitter account that's great to follow because I announce all my stuff. And then there's all those threads we were talking about. But, you know, Twitter's hard to keep up with. So I also have a newsletter, which that one's at criticalkate.substack.com. But it's also linked at the bottom of acriticalhit.com. It's linked to on my Twitter account. I try to link all these things together, you know, but there's so many different places. The newsletter is great because I not only announce my articles and videos, but I also archive links to all the major Twitter threads so that you don't miss any of those. Plus, I like to link to other cool stuff I find written by other people.
I'll have links to all of these and much of the stuff we spoke about in this interview in the episode notes, which you can always find at my website, lifeandtimes.games. As a reminder, this interview is part of a new series that I'm running alongside the usual documentary and narrative style stuff. I've run interviews before this with the individuals behind Shmupulations, the CRPG Addict, the Obscuratory, as well as Kelsey Lewin from the Video Game History Foundation, Sam Dyer from Bitmap Books, and most recently, Andrew Borman from the Strong Museum of Play. And I have lots more planned for the future. If you have any suggestions or requests for people you'd like to hear me talk to, hit me up on Twitter using either at LifeandTimesVG or at MossRC, or email me on richard@lifeandtimes.games. And as always, remember that you can support my work through paypal.me/MossRC or patreon.com/lifeandtimesvideogames. Or by grabbing one of my books. So stay tuned for the next regular episode of the show later this month. It'll be on the ever-useful website and database Moby Games. And then hopefully from there, I'll have a return-to-usual service through the rest of Season 5. It's been a weird year for me so far, with great things happening that I didn't plan for, that are causing major delays on the cool projects that I did plan. More on that another time. For now, my name is Richard Moss, and this was a Life and Times Video Games interview special. Thanks for listening. I'll see ya.